Hi, this is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
We continue here on a Wednesday, and joining me is a crowd favorite, none other than the one and only Grant Newsham. So, Grant, first of all, good morning, and good morning from the United States, wherever you are. Well, I know where you are. You're in Taiwan. I've never been to Taiwan, so what's it like? Is it much different than every place else in the Far East? Is it similar and different? Greetings and salutations, and tell us about Taiwan. What's it like?
Yeah, it's like going to Japan about 1982. I think if you were in Japan in 1982, you'd know what I mean. It's like an older Japan that hasn't really gotten made shiny. You know, there's just a ton of old 70s era buildings around, and it kind of brings to mind the set of the William Holden movie, what was it, The Life of Susie Wong, where I'm living at least. You know, you're in this very Chinesey neighborhood. You know, it smells Chinesey, it is Chinesey, because everybody here is Chinesey, and you know, it's a little old, and you know, it's a humid environment, so you get a sort of a smell and a dampness to it all. But it's like a China, another way to describe it is like a China with really nice people. You know, everybody's, you know, by and large are friendly, and there's a brightness to the character of Taiwanese that you don't find at all in the mainland. So physically it looks like Japan. Say back in the 1980s, if anyone's been to Tokyo, if you go to Ueno Park, Ueno area, that's the older part of Tokyo. That's what most of Taipei is like. There are some shinier places, but by and large, it is going back in time. They don't mind their Japanese colonial buildings, so there's a lot of old buildings from back in that era in certain places. But it is the temperament of the Taiwanese that really jumps out at you. It's just brighter, more friendly, open than Japanese, and they're just nicer than mainland Chinese. It's almost like it's a completely different sort of person. But Taipei itself is in a bowl, so it gets just literally hotter than hell, and it's got a smog problem also. So, but it's mid-April now, and it feels like New Orleans in late July.
Good.
To give you some idea. But that said, you know, everybody goes around sort of dressed like lance corporals on liberty, you know, in shorts and flip-flops and t-shirts and stuff. So
wow.
You can get away with that. But it is a Chinese democracy, you know, with consensual government. We'll see for how much longer, because there is a very aggressive mainland Chinese PRC subversion campaign that's underway, and I think it has had some success. But it's an interesting place to go. I wish I spoke Chinese, but I don't. But a lot of people speak English, so that's not a problem.
Give us, as long as you're there and as long as we're on the subject, it's not a subject that I think we've ever entertained before. So what's the Chinese plan relative to Taiwan?
It's to strangle it the way, say, a python does an antelope, and have the Taiwanese just eventually have enough and say, okay, what sort of deal can we cut? You apply economic pressure. You apply the physical bullying that goes on, you know, with the Chinese military is always threatening, you know, flying around, sailing around the island.
Right.
And if you read the propaganda, it's blood-curdling.
Oh.
you know, we're coming, we're going to get you, you know, there's nothing you can do, give up. And if you don't, you know, if you don't give up, we're going to kill you. You know, which is pretty much what they say to the Americans as well, but they say it even more to Taiwan. And Taiwan, the Taiwanese are only 90 miles away, or not very far. And there is the military imbalance is overwhelming, and then some. But so the idea is to sort of just browbeat the Taiwanese into giving up and, you know, just sort of saying, okay, we're part of China. What, how much freedom can we get for how long? And then Taiwan just gets sort of absorbed. There is, of course, the military option, which is to attack and, you know, sort of invade Taiwan. And that is certainly doable. I think Taiwan could, China could give it a pretty good go right now. But that's not what they want. They would rather get it more easily. And that's where the subversion, the psychological pressure, intimidation, which is the Chinese MO, the Chinese Communist Party MO, and has been for a long time, that's where that plays in. And you're seeing it just firsthand, and it's but that's sort of psychological warfare. It's not as easy to see as, you know, as ships and aircraft and soldiers and this sort of thing. So there's a tendency either to ignore it or to downplay it, but it's definitely there, and you know that's something that one really needs to keep in mind when thinking about Taipei or Taiwan. Because a lot of people do just think of the problem, how would you do an amphibious assault, an airborne assault on Taiwan? And yeah, that's an interesting question, an important one, but it's the psychological warfare, the political subversion that I think is the thing really to watch about. And you'll notice also there's this this isolation that Taiwan is feeling. You know, their diplomatic allies are gradually getting picked off by China when Taiwan wants to be part of, you know, wants to join something like ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Organization, or the World Health Organization, or anything, any international organization or regional organization. Taiwan or China prevents it. And it's really uncouth, uncivilized behavior, sort of like a modern version of the Mongols back in the 13th century, but without the nice parts.
The Chinese. I want to ask you another question. In the news here in the last, I don't know, in the last few days or since I talked to you, that would be a couple weeks ago, but it seems like the president of the Philippines, it seems to be very quietly, without a lot of rhetoric, which is odd for him, is pushing back against the Chinese. I guess fortifying some of the islands and in a low tone, telling the Chinese that, hey, this is not going to work the way you're drawing it up. Can you explain? Can you give us a footnote to go with that?
I don't think Duterte, the president, I don't think he's really changed. You know, he's corrupt. He's been on the Chinese payroll from back when he was the governor down in Mindanao. But I think he's feeling some pressure domestically inside the Philippines, where there's always been a slice of that ruling class that doesn't like him. And that is kind of does not like what China is doing to the Philippines. They don't like the Philippines being like humiliated 24/7 by the Chinese. There's resentment over the millions of Chinese workers who have been allowed into the Philippines during Duterte's administration. There's a sense that there's been really few economic benefits from Chinese investment that Duterte was talking up. So I think part of this is a reaction to what he sees as real or potential domestic opposition to him. And he's trying to, I think, do the minimum to keep himself viable and kind of to keep whatever financial arrangements he has to keep those things going. So I think he's trying to adjust to a shift in public thinking and thinking within the ruling class. But I don't know that he's really turned against the Chinese at all.
Okay, so this is for domestic consumption.
I think there is that, because these guys, you know, it is sort of a Game of Thrones sort of society in the Philippines, with the factions in this elite class that are always scheming against each other and looking to get rid of the other guy and put themselves in power with all the access that gives to money-making opportunities. But one thing to keep in mind about, say what one will about Duterte, and that from the time he took over, you know, the Americans have still had a relationship with him and with the Philippines. And you still have American military training going on, joint exercises with the Philippine military. So he hasn't cut the Americans loose at all. But obviously it's a different relationship. It's frosty, and he is much closer to the Chinese than anyone would like. But the Americans, as I say, still have a relationship, still train and have a military presence, and that may even expand a little bit. But there certainly was no love lost between Duterte and Mr. Obama.
Yeah, Barack Obama seemed to have that way with the leaders around the world. Benjamin Netanyahu with Vladimir Putin. It seems like a very agreeable sort. He didn't get along well with people.
No, well, unless you were an enemy of America.
then he got along fine. I said that to somebody yesterday, and they looked at me like, President Obama? I'm like, you should do some reading.
Yeah, you know, one doesn't say, you know, one feels sad saying that. But that's kind of how it was, and I think that just reflected a sort of a mindset from where he came from, that sort of leftist end of academia, thinking, well, that if anyone doesn't like America, it's our fault. Therefore, if we're just nice to them, they will see what great guys we are, and we'll have a great relationship. And since problems are our fault, anyone who likes us, say in Israel, et cetera, has got to be that's the reason why we have problems, so we should be mean to them and knuckle under. Plus, you saw Chicago politics on display at a national level. But Duterte despised Mr. Obama, and I think the feeling was mutual. But those days are gone, at least until another election. Could go back with another election, but it's a different time, and now it's up to Mr. Trump to try to improve things. And I think with the Philippines, it's by no means a lost cause, but we've sort of put ourselves a few runs down by the way we handled things back in the 2012-2014 timeframe.
Since we're going down this road, let's. What impact is the Trans-Pacific Partnership? What impact did that play? Depending on who you read, that was an opening for the Chinese, and no void will go unfilled in that part of the world, in any part of the world for that matter. But what role did the Trans-Pacific Partnership and President Trump's turning his back on that have to do? And as of yet, I've seen nothing that has been negotiated that replaces that, which he's talked about on a number of occasions. We're going to get a better deal. So, did we in fact allow China? Did we turn our back a little bit on the Western Pacific? Give me your thoughts on that.
I think with the TPP, it's a trade agreement that was going to involve a number of countries in the Pacific Rim and not include China. You know, I think if it was up to me, I would have joined in. I think it did.
Why would you have joined in if you were queen for a day and on that day we were considering TPP? Why would you have joined in?
I think there was a political, psychological advantage to it, specifically because it That wasn't an organization, it was an trade agreement that used American rules for international trade. You know, some of the ideas we have about honoring contracts, intellectual property protections, and what we would consider pretty much fair trade, as opposed to the kind of trade one does with China, which is completely unfair and dishonest and skewed entirely in China's favor. So it was more, it reflected sort of a fairly broad consensus among a wide range of countries. It reflected a belief that the American approach to trade, even international relations, was the better one. And that, I think, was a good reason to do it. Plus, it also showed America was genuinely interested and committed to this sort of doing the necessary diplomatic and administrative work to really run or be the key player, along with Japan, in a sort of a regional trade agreement. And that's the real reason. In terms of economic benefit, I don't know. I think that you can argue that both ways, and I've heard it argued both ways. If you actually read the agreement, what it reminded me of, it reminded me of some major U.S. industries that can afford to pay lawyers any amount of money to lobby in Washington, D.C. to have an agreement written a certain way. It almost seemed as though some of the provisions were written by the Pharmaceutical Industries Lobbying Association. So it certainly, I think special pleading is the word. It was an agreement that that certainly would benefit some major American industries, but that benefits them. I don't think it was written so much with sort of the idea of giving the greatest amount of good to the greatest amount of people. The way it works is that specific industries, all they care about is getting their terms into an agreement, and so they will benefit. But so I'm not sure how this would have played out. I almost think it would have been a wash in economic terms, maybe have some slight benefit from just a general sort of expansion in trade. But I don't think it was a great panacea to fix an economy. But politically and psychologically, I think it was important to have gone, stayed with it. But because when you don't, then it, as you say, it leaves a vacuum. I'm not sure it's a sort of a perfect example because it's not as if the Chinese suddenly took over. It's just you took over America's place in TPP. But it did allow Chinese sort of economic activity or business trade activity to really continue sort of unchecked or without any opposition to it. And that's where I think there was a lost opportunity. It is worth noting, of course, that Hillary Clinton was equally opposed to it. So Donald Trump, I think, gets outsized blame for this. It's really people who just despise Donald Trump, and anything he does, they will blame him as the source of all problems in Asia. But so there, he does get criticized unfairly for it. I don't know that his efforts to address trade bilaterally have been all that successful just yet. So it's, you know, I see a lost opportunity, but you know, it's not the end of the game. And we still do a lot of business out here, always have, and probably always will. And we, you know, militarily, we've not pulled back, diplomatically, and America's still out here. So one always hears, well, Donald Trump is, you know, pulled out of Asia. He's caused concern with our allies who think we're leaving. Well, people say that, but it's more a reflection of how much one hates Donald Trump. If you look at the facts, America's still out here and still doing a lot of things.
All right. I appreciate that. Give us your take on the economic negotiations between the United States and the Chinese. Are they the longer they go, do the Chinese have an advantage because the president is getting pushed against an election? Or is their economic situation putting pressure on President Xi. So there's pressure on both of them. Your thoughts on what if anything you've heard in terms of how that goes, and does either nation have an upper hand?
I think the Americans have the advantage, and nobody knows how this is going to turn out. We're waiting to see which faction in the administration gets its way. There's obviously the so-called hardliners, the ones who simply want to take a commonsensical approach to dealing with China and insist on reciprocal fair trade. And then there's the appeasers, or the ones who just want to get back to the way things were because they were making money, and that's really reflected by the Secretary of Treasury, Steve Mnuchin, who used to be with Goldman Sachs. They, as I say, are, I think, appeasers is not a bad word, and I think it's probably a nice word, actually, because I think it has more to do with them making a ton of money if things go back, if there's an agreement reached, regardless, and things go kind of back to the way they were. The sticking point, of course, is how is you going to guarantee that China lives up to any agreement it reaches? And that, I think, is probably an insurmountable problem. Because no matter what is agreed to, no matter what public statements are made, China will not live up to it. They just can't. You know, it's sort of the way a dog licks itself. It just can't help it. And so I have no idea how we're going to overcome this. And that's why I hope that Mr. Trump keeps tariffs on, and I hope that he also is willing to start delisting Chinese companies on the New York Stock Exchange, or making, say, ZTE go out of business, that telecom company that he sanctioned and reprieved. So I think America's got the better hand to play. I think China is, as I've noted before, they're short of cash, and their economy is much worse than they claim it is, with unemployment very high, the economy stumbling. And as I said, they're running out of money, and that's the longer this goes, the longer Mr. Trump keeps the pressure on, I think that the more difficult their situation becomes. But the problem is to getting them to change behavior. And, you know, I really don't know how that's going to happen, so I would just be inclined to really keep the pressure on them and also get used to the idea that the relationship is not going back to normal, and that supply chains and businesses are just going to have to adjust, and we're even going to have to wean ourselves off this myth of the Chinese market and the myth of becoming rich as Croesus from China. I don't know how it's going to play out. I think we have the advantage if we play our hand well, and that remains to be seen.
Right. It seems like we constantly, and when you look at the economic reality between the two countries, it's astounding that Americans representing this country have agreed to you look at President Obama, you look at President Bush, and you just think, what in God's name were you thinking, that we're really not going to move them, so we're really not going to try, and we'll look the other way with all the industrial espionage and the economic blackmail that goes on, and we'll just call it good and pretend. And that's what we've done. And I applaud the president. The economic confrontation with China is a long time in coming, and a long time in needing to come. And so I hope we stick to our guns. Let's go up to North Korea. We had a not so successful summit. Where are we there?
I think we're cracking open a big can of Schadenfreude, sort of 16-ouncer, over South Korea, President Moon's embarrassment. It's kind of funny because he's starting to look pretty desperate, almost begging Kim to cooperate and reach a deal. And I think we're heading back to where we were probably when all this started about a year and a half ago. That I don't see the North Koreans doing what we want them to do. I think the Moon regime in South Korea is really feeling some pain because they're not, you know, they thought they were going to work something out, you know, between us Koreans, and it hasn't happened. And Moon is starting to face some domestic challenges, not least the South Korean economy is bad and hasn't been very good for a long time. And, you know, people tend to prioritize that sort of thing over foreign relations when things get bad enough. And I think it's headed that way for South Korea. So, yeah, I think that Moon is going to, you know, the taste is going to wear off, I think, amongst enough of the Korean population. And I think there'll be another, eventually there'll be another government that sort of isn't quite so naively optimistic about what's achievable with North Korea. But I think this is, it's just going to continue like it has. And, you know, maybe this is how it was always going to end up anyway. I think the Trump regime is going to go back to sort of applying more pressure on North Korea. And I think what I'm looking to see is for them to really start doing the secondary sanctions, to start punishing Chinese companies that are, particularly Chinese financial institutions that are keeping North Korea afloat. So I think we're going to sort of go, say, revert back to something like it was before the Olympics when South Korea sort of undercut Mr. Trump's approach. And it's going to be a tougher, more aggressive stance towards North Korea, even more than it has been. And what I think will be the bellwether is if the Americans and their allies actually someday seize one of the sanctions-busting ships that they spot and know all about, these things that are transferring oil and other goods to Chinese ships in the East China Sea in that region, that I think once we actually grab one of those ships, then you'll know we're really serious and that things have ratcheted up. But that's been a long time coming. I don't know when it's going to happen.
Interesting. You know, it seems like we could have an agreement with the North Koreans. We just have to do about that which we'd have to do to have it one with the Chinese, which is to capitulate what the things that we believe in and agree to what they want, and then we could have an agreement. And it seems to be that is the way of the Western Pacific relative to our adversaries. You can have an agreement, you just have to capitulate. And you made a statement months ago, and I love quoting it. You know, it's the United States is finally standing up on its hind legs and looking at these governments and saying, you know, we'll come to the table, but you have to make a fair deal, which is something the United States hasn't done in decades. So it's and then it seems like very much the same behavior from the North Koreans. Come out and say all the right things, and then actions never equal anything close to the rhetoric. So I guess we can have an agreement. We just have to capitulate. So that
helps, and that's always been our specialty. You know, that we have a tendency to think that if you reach an agreement, if you talk to somebody long enough or even short enough, and reach an agreement, that's a success. You know, you've moved the ball forward a little bit. And in diplomats, that actually is considered a good day's work, is to actually have a signing agreement, pose for photographs, and then you move on to your next job. But nobody ever keeps score as to how well these things work out. But this administration is, you know, the first one to not be in such a hurry to sort of have a signing ceremony about things. And I hope they can keep this approach up. I think it has discombobulated a lot of people, both our allies and our adversaries, to actually have an America that isn't so eager to reach a deal. And you see this in the business world, too, where Westerners and Americans go to Asia and routinely get fleeced because they got to reach a deal before their flight goes back to the U.S. Mm-hmm. And well, you know, it's when you need a deal more than the other guy, it's not really the best position to be in.
But that as long as you'll get on all fours, right, and not stand up on your hind legs, you can have the best deal you can make on your hands and knees. So go ahead. And the United States has been more than okay doing that. And you wonder why some of the nonsense has gone on with the Chinese for decades. That's the requirement. If you'll do that, you can make quote unquote progress, and then you can call it whatever you want to call it. It's not going to be a good deal. They will continue to steal your intellectual property. They will continue to act like economic gangsters around the world. They can continue dumping steel and other commodities, you know, using proxies into the United States. And all that's good as long as we don't look at them and call it for what it is. And so, it's interesting. It's interesting. And again, the behavior seems to be, you know, the same, which is a lot of rhetoric, and at the end of the day, as you said, getting the Chinese to live up to an agreement, that would be, I mean, Grant, how stunned would you be if we signed an agreement and the Chinese actually lived up to it?
Oh, I'd be as stunned as if my Labrador Retriever started talking to me. I'm not being mean, you know, or trying to be glib, but
you're using a lot of dog metaphors today. The dog licking themselves. You have a picture of your Labrador in front of you as we do this.
No, it comes to mind. It's just something that isn't likely to happen, right. And it's just the way it is, and. You know, particularly if you can get away with it, well, why not? And that's the, you know, we tend to think of, well, let's split the difference and shake hands and Everybody wins. But there's a Chinese expression that translates into you die, I live. And it's very much a peasant mentality or mentality, you know, that comes of being from a country that has been chaotic and violent and deadly for a long time. That people do have a tendency to see things as a zero-sum game, and that you get everything you possibly can for yourself, and that's the only way you survive. And yet we see things, we tend to take a different approach to it. I think if our historic experiences were reversed, we would probably we'd be very different in how we look at things, and the Chinese would too. So I think a lot of it's a sort of a fairly understandable, predictable outgrowth of historic experience and just the way a culture develops over a few thousand years.
All right. Now, you wrote a piece recently for a magazine called And Magazine. You can find it on their website, andmagazine.com, A-N-D magazine. I'm not going to spell that for you, .com. And it's about the 1MDB Goldman Sachs little event that happened in the not too distant future. So I want you to first of all refresh everybody's memory what that was all about, and then explain to us what was the gist of your article.
Here's what happened. This was probably when was it 2012, 15, that time frame roughly. Malaysia had an infrastructure investment fund, which means the government put together some money and they were going to build infrastructure. To get the money, the Malaysian government, they issued bonds, and then people would buy the bonds and the Malaysian government would get the money and you would use it for infrastructure projects. The fund was known as 1MDB, and that's the name. The guy behind the fund, or who was really pulling all the strings, was in fact the Prime Minister of Malaysia, a fellow named Najib. So to raise the money, or part of it, that they did several bond offerings that were arranged by Goldman Sachs. And so the Malaysian government sold these bonds that had been the deal arranged, say, by Goldman, and people bought it. And in Goldman's case, they raised about $6.5 billion. Goldman got about $600 million for their trouble, which was way more than the going rate for that kind of work. But Goldman Sachs just said, well, they wanted it quickly, so we had to charge them more.
Of course.
But $600 million is a lot of money, even for those kind of companies. And but here's what happened is that the Prime Minister of Malaysia was using one MDB as his piggy bank. So several billion dollars disappeared.
Uh-oh.
And was used for all, you know, buying yachts, making movies. That Wolf of Wall Street movie, in fact, was financed with one MDB money. And there were a couple of Malaysian Chinese frontmen involved in all of this. And to get the deals, of course, Goldman Sachs, the executives were bribing people, taking kickbacks, and they got a nice cut of the loot as well. And this has all come to light, and the U.S. Government, the Department of Justice, has sued some of the Goldman Sachs officials. They've gone after the Chinese frontmen. And the Malaysian government as well has arrested the prime minister, and they're suing him also. So Goldman Sachs, of course, says, you know, well, we didn't know what was going on. You know, we had no way of knowing what the Malaysians were going to do with the money, or what the prime minister was going to do with the money. And then they, as is predictable, they say, well, these executives who, you know, have admitted to wrongdoing, in fact, well, they were just rogue employees. We had nothing to do with it. We couldn't have known. And so what I, my art, and that's the basic background. So my article is saying that, well, Goldman Sachs probably should have known, and that any competent company would have known and would have turned down the business. And then I explain how you can tell if a company is serious, and that is, it depends on how their compliance, the people who prevent against doing business with criminals, that's how they are regarded and how they're treated and set up within the firm. And then I explain also that ultimately that nothing's going to change, that this is probably going to happen again, unless three things are done by the American government in particular. And the first one is to suspend the banking license of one of these financial companies. They never do that. They claim the economic disruption and job losses will be too great. Mm-hmm. And then you have to also make the top dogs at these financial firms, make them pay. Malaysia is probably going to ask for at least $600 million back. And what you need to do is have the top guys pay it out of their, write a check from their own account, because it's always paid by insurance or by the firm at large. And then the third thing is you've really got to put one of these guys in prison. If you do that, then you might get a change in behavior. That would be, but this is about as hard as changing Chinese behavior when it comes to changing the behavior of American financial institutions, particularly the really big ones. So that's the Cliff Notes version.
All right. So let me ask you, first of all, MDB, Malaysia Developmental, what does it say? What's the B?
It's a Malaysian word, as I recall, for a company, or like incorporated.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So now I understand that. Is that any different than business in the United States in terms of paying off people and greasing skids and is it more overt? Is it less overt? Is it more accepted? Because we act with moral indignation when these things happen in our country. Is it any different in the Western Pacific?
You know, that's a fair question, and I think it's a good one. Ultimately, no, I don't think there's that much different. Where it differs is in the specifics. Because in America, if you tried to do something like this the way Najib, the Prime Minister of Malaysia, and his henchmen tried to do it, and the way even Goldman Sachs guys went about it, that you'd get caught pretty quickly. So what you find is that the specifics, the way that the corruption works, it varies from country to country, I think depending on the prospects for getting caught. And if the guys know that they're going to get caught if they do something a certain way, they'll do it another way.
Right.
And the Enron scandals of the early 2000s were just classic examples of that, that if you read the details and what these pedigreed guys with Ivy League MBAs, et cetera, friends of presidents, et cetera, were doing, you could read what they were doing, you're thinking, wow, this is like what the Yakuza or the organized crime does in Asia. But they're just doing it differently. So ultimately, I don't think there's any huge differences. This is in terms of quantitatively, or even qualitatively, but the way it works, the way it's done in a given case will differ. When I started doing a lot of work on corruption in Asia, Japan in particular, I was pretty self-righteous for a long time about how, these Japanese are so corrupt. And then the more I figured things out, the more I realized that anything I could say about Asia, Asian corruption, you could look at the United States and in poker terms say, well, I'll see you in Asia one.
Right.
We could come up with, we just do it differently. But that said, it doesn't mean you ignore the one MDB scandals and this sort of thing. Maybe it is shoveling against the tide, and nothing will ever change. But when you can get a shot at somebody who's done something, I think it's fair to, doesn't wish to be mean, but it's good to have governments try to uphold standards. Because this sort of theft, it really hurts a country. And ultimately, it's the citizenry writ large who do suffer, because the money that gets stolen is money that can't be used for other things that benefit more people.
When I think about that, isn't that just a game that is played by rich, rich people around the world, that the rules really don't apply to me, and the way we're going to sanitize this is this. I mean, I know people that are Democrats will recoil when I say this, but the Clinton Foundation, dare I say? I know everybody knows that wasn't about pay for play, but it seems really odd the way the donations have dried up to that thing, if it was just all about altruism. So I just, the more I watch it, and people that are so adamantly and opposed to Donald Trump, when you say, but you see Donald Trump as simply the other side of the coin from Hillary Clinton, right? The Clintons, there is no difference between the two. The truth doesn't emanate from their mouths, only a version that corresponds with the reality they are selling on that given day. Right? And they never take responsibility for anything, just go on to the next event. And people look at you with their indignation and they say, oh my God, how could you say that? And you're saying, because it's true. It's the rich people rules around the country. And so, I don't know, these things come to my head because in Iraq, we're trying to stand up the border patrol. Well, why do you want to stand up the border? Why do you want to work for the border patrol, Mr. Iraqi guy? You got to go out there for a month and then you come home for 2 weeks and you go back out for a month. Why? Because the money is really good in the border patrol. The border patrol is better money than anybody. Yeah, but the pay is the same. I didn't say the pay. I said the money. Oh, you mean from smugglers? Yes. Why do you think I want to go out there and stand out there when it's hotter than hell? It's a lucrative business because they have to pay, right? They have to pay. And then we would get indignant. Oh, they're on the take. And like, well, have you ever been, right, to the waterfronts in New Jersey and New York City? Do you think that's not a cash, that's not a cash business? So I don't know. I'm with you. I mean, sanctimonious Americans rolling around the planet, right? And when we do very much the same here, and maybe just a little bit more overt, and maybe it's just been a more accepted part of their cultures when we at least put up the facade of we don't really do this. You know, we're Americans, where other nations say, of course we do it. It's the way people get elected. It's the way things happen. So I don't know. Your thoughts on all that?
Yeah, you know, I think if you've been around, once you've been around a while, like I think we have, you know, you think about things. Yeah, I think you're right. The, I've always thought every country has the same basic amount of criminality. It just shows up differently depending on prospects for getting caught. But if you look at, say, the U.S. politicians, the former politicians, former officials, who leave office and then they go to work as lobbyists, and just take the ones who've gone to work on behalf of China. This is a bipartisan effort. Former Defense Secretary William Cohen, you know, considered a sort of an upright guy. He's been a Chinese lobbyist for a long time. Henry Kissinger is a good example. And you just go down the list, even Joe Lieberman, the thought to be principled fellow from Connecticut. He signed up as a lobbyist for ZTE, the Chinese telecom company. It's an easy, if I had to argue the positions, I would rather argue yours rather than that we are in some ways cleaner than anyone else.
Right.
I think there is certainly a class aspect to this. There's different rules for sort of people higher up the ladder. Consider the outcome of the 2008 financial collapse. Who actually got punished for that? Of the top dogs of the Wall Street firms and even the sort of U.S. regulators who allowed this to happen, either through intentionally or incompetence. Who actually got punished? Nobody. And that tells you plenty. I actually refer to it in my article. There was a Rolling Stone reporter named Matt Taibbi, T-A-I-B-B-I, and he wrote a series of articles after the financial collapse about the wrongdoing on Wall Street and the fact that nobody's been punished for it. And he really writes well. And he's an excellent investigative reporter. And he effectively laid out the brief for any halfway diligent prosecutor to go after really the top guys in Wall Street firms. And he accuses them in detail of wrongdoing, and not just causing the collapse, but after it in capitalizing on the government's efforts to fix things. And the thing to note is that nobody sued Matt Taibbi. And considering what he accused these people of, you would have to sue. The fact he was not sued tells you plenty. but what happened is that the Wall Street titans and actually the U.S. regulators, who he's equally critical of, what they do is they ignore you. That's as effective as attacking you, but they just ignored him. But his stuff is really worth reading, and it's interesting. He writes well. He's funny. And you have to read. I think he has probably written the best stuff on the financial collapse and the corruption surrounding it. But I highly recommend him. So I'm with you. But this has probably been something like, if there was like a 3,000-year-old Greek guy from ancient Greek days, he'd probably tell us, yeah, well, what took you so long to figure this out? I imagine this is just part and parcel of human nature. But it doesn't mean that one throws up their hands and says, well, corruption's corruption, nothing we can do, get everything you can for yourself. But rather, you know, there are guys who, there's plenty of people who do sort of want to do what's right and to, at least to the extent possible, run as clean a society, as clean a company or business, as clean a government operation as they possibly can. Maybe those people stand out for their rarity, but I think there's more of them than we think. And that's, but it's probably an age-old problem. But I think you've got it right. If I was in Iraqi, I'd want to be on the border patrol too. That's where the money is.
And it's where it's always been. It used to be smuggling pornography and alcohol when Saddam was in power. Now it was satellite dishes and what was the other thing? I can't remember. And it's been going on for since the time of Christ. That's an ancient smuggling route down the Euphrates River Valley, and it's why families have traditions of being involved with the border. And so it's interesting. What give me something you're looking at. What are you writing next, or give me a piece of information that you're intrigued with in the Western Pacific?
One thing I'm interested in looking at is the Taiwan situation, of course. But I'm particularly interested in the problem that Taiwan faces that comes of really 40 years of isolation, and specifically looking at the Taiwan military that really for 40 years has been isolated. Yes, American, officers come through and small training teams are here and observers go back and forth, but the Americans and the Taiwanese have never really done joint exercises. They don't do joint training, and we act as if they're lepers. So what we do is we just talk and say, yeah, you guys are great. We support you, and here's some gifts, and they give us gifts. But they never actually get to go out and train with us. So it's what they become is like a baseball team that never gets to play a game. What you have are you have chalk talks, and then you split up and have an intra-squad game. And you're using scrounged up equipment as well, because the Americans won't sell them what they want or what they need even, because China will be angry. So this has had a demoralizing effect on the Taiwan military. I think it's shaped the way that Taiwan government sees defense, and even the public at large doesn't have that much confidence in the military. So this is something that I think needs addressed, is we have got to actually treat the Taiwan military like friends and actually let them do stuff, come out and train with us. I'm proposing I'd like to have us set up a Central Pacific HADR force based in Taiwan and using American and Taiwanese amphibious forces to plan, exercise, train for HADR, disaster relief operations.
Yeah, explain to everybody what HADR is.
Yeah, it's humanitarian assistance, disaster relief. So disaster relief is the thing. So if there's an earthquake or a typhoon, you go out and save people. And that's my idea is it's a way to get Taiwan's military out of its isolation, let them actually associate with the Americans and work with us. And I think we'll find the knock-on effects to be beneficial. I hope we haven't waited too long, however. But this is something that needs to be done. But you find that successive State Departments and even Defense Departments have all been too afraid of what China will do, or China will think if we are too nice to Taiwan. And as a result, we've just barely given Taiwan enough oxygen to survive, but not enough to actually thrive and develop themselves. And has any of this forbearance and restraint, has it had a beneficial effect on Chinese behavior? I would suggest not. So that's the one thing that I'm considering and writing about, is trying to break this isolation that has really has hurt Taiwan, the military, but also had, as I said, political and psychological effects as well. So,
but again, I think maybe that might be one of the longer. I mean, it's the same Chinese game, though, right? We're gonna tell you what we want. We are going to then tell you how we want you to treat this. There could be no two China policy for the United States. And slowly but surely, so what are we gonna do? Are we gonna wait till the little green men are running around Taiwan and then put our hands up and say, oh my God, it's happening to us again? It's the same tired act it's the same tired act over and over and over again, Grant, where, you know, it's the world according to Garp. And don't look at reality, right? Look at the shiny object I'm showing you, and then don't say a word, because if you say a word, something bad will happen. You know, we're going to put you on double secret probation or whatnot. And then what we find out is, wait a minute, when you actually stand on your hind legs and when you actually say, no, we're not doing that, oh, my God, guess what happened? They stopped. They froze because they need us. We simply, I don't know. It's like we have been dealing with the Chinese. I wonder if they, when they get into a room, if they just laugh and say, oh, my God, they did it again. And we didn't think they'd roll over again, and they roll over every time. They come so desperate to make a deal, it's absolutely stunning. And they walk out of here with nothing, you know, and they're happy. They're so happy. It's so wonderful. Do you think they laugh at us, Grant? Do you think they have a good chuckle before they all go home?
Well, they might. They wouldn't surprise me. I think they're certainly, I would laugh if I was them. They must be telling each other, well, these Americans must think that we're Canadians. I wouldn't blame them if they did. And, you know, I hope we haven't waited too long and eventually find ourselves one day with a problem that you've just described. But this has been, you know, we should have gotten started on this at least a decade ago. So I'm not sure how this is going to play out. The game's not over, but unfortunately, I think it is bottom of the seventh. We're probably down by a few runs. So
now, speaking of baseball, Bryce Harper went to the Phillies. Did that cause you any amount of pain?
No. I'm a Senators fan, as I've said, so I'm kind of a loser. They were pretty good for a few years, and that was really an unexpected benefit, sort of bonus. And now if they leave, well, this is like the Minnesota Twins and Harmon Killebrew moving to Minnesota that I remember hearing about when I was really little.
Right.
So I expect, you know, if you do have somehow have some good players, you kind of expect them to go somewhere else. So, being a Senators fan, you have very low expectations. So it makes it a little easier to go through life without quite as much success as you would like.
All right.
But I thought, good for him. But having to live in Philly.
You know, I don't know. I've never been to Philadelphia, I don't think.
It has a reputation.
Right.
You know, I think it's apocryphal that on W.C. Field's tombstone it is said to say that on the whole I'd rather be here than in Philadelphia. I think it's apocryphal, but it sounds good.
All right. What's the next thing we will read from you?
Hopefully something like I just described, okay, about helping Taiwan break out of its isolation.
All right. Well, Grant, first of all, always wonderful to catch up with you and for you to make it smart on things, current events in the Western Pacific. So good luck in Taiwan and travel safe, and we will talk to you soon.
Well, thanks very much. Always appreciate it.
All right. Grant Newsham, more of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.